Okay, well, it looks like we are it, so we will go ahead and get into our session for today. This session is on legal issues involving students and parents' rights. And before we get started, excuse me, let's bow for a word of prayer. Father, we are thankful for just the opportunity to fellowship together, to learn together, the privilege, Father, to share. And Lord, I ask now that you would be with each school that's here at this conference, with administration and teachers, staff, board members. Lord, may they be encouraged and uplifted. And Father, I pray that during this session you would just meet with us, open our hearts and our minds in a way, Lord, that we would learn, that, Father, we would be challenged. Lord, may we share that which would be beneficial. And Father, I just pray now for each ministry. May you pour out your blessings. May they reflect you in a way that is encourages parents and students. Father, now we just ask that you would give us wisdom during this time. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, this session we are looking at legal issues involving parents and students' rights. And as we do that, we need to understand that enrollment in the school, in a private Christian school, faith-based program, is based upon a contract. That contract is between the parents and the school. So, in terms of understanding that, understand, first of all, that parents have a right to enroll their children in a Christian school. They do not have a right to enroll their child in a particular Christian school. So a parent can say, I've got a right to enroll my child in a non-public school, in a private Christian school, but a parent cannot come up to you and say, I've got a constitutional right to enroll my child in your school. Enrollment in your school, in about 95% of the cases, is going to be on the basis of a contract. That contract is a reciprocal contract. So, for example, Johnny's mom and dad decide they want to enroll their child in the school. They'll call the school up and they'll say, give us information. Usually the school will give them a packet. That packet contains enrollment materials. We suggest that it also contains the student handbook, even if it was last year's student handbook. And that student handbook, along with their enrollment materials, parent is going to look through that. They're going to sign the enrollment materials. Maybe the school requires testing. Maybe the school requires a parent interview. The school may require a registration fee or an application fee. Johnny's mom and dad read all of that and say, that's what we want for Johnny. And so they turn it into the school. School gets that information, looks through the application, maybe does the testing, maybe conducts the interview and says, oh, okay, we'll accept Johnny into the school. What you have at that point is a reciprocal contract. That is, parent makes an offer. That offer is Johnny in the school. The school makes an offer. That offer is, here's all the terms and conditions of enrollment. And parent accepts that by paying the fee. What has happened is, in this reciprocal contract, almost all of the rights that the parent or the student has vis-a-vis the school are established. So if I want to regulate the rights between the school and the student, between the school and the parent, I'm going to do that in terms of my enrollment materials and my student handbook. So what I have then is, while there is no right to acceptance in the school per se, whatever I want to establish in terms of the relationship is established by that contract. So I want my student handbook my application materials to state the basis of the enrollment. Let's take the illustration where I want Johnny is an okay student, not a problem. He makes good grades, every once in a while he gets into trouble. The problem is Johnny's mom or dad. They are driving the teacher up the wall, constantly calling, constantly getting other parents stirred up. I don't like this, I don't like that. You begin to wonder, why in the world did you enroll Johnny in the school in the first place if everything we're doing you don't like? Constant challenge, constant issues. Now, I want to disenroll Johnny in the school. And you notice I use the word disenroll as opposed to expel. Expel has the connotation of something negative. Disenroll carries no negative connotation. It's not Johnny's behavior that I'm expelling. It is not Johnny who has done something. Rather, it is Johnny's parents that are really not supportive of the ministry, not supportive of the program of the school. If I want to regulate that relationship, where would I go in order to regulate the relationship where I can disenroll Johnny because of the conduct of the parent? I would go to the contract. And that contract is going to be in my application materials, in the student handbook, in the application materials. I'm going to say, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, I agree to abide by the policies and procedures in the handbook. I've read the handbook. So I've got parent agreeing to abide by those policies and procedures, which include, if the parent is non-supportive, I can disenroll Johnny from the school. So in terms of the rights that students and parents have, a majority of those rights, that's a huge majority, are going to come in terms of the contract for enrollment, the student handbook, application forms, etc.
This is all better than dismiss. I think our language
is dismissed. Kind of carries the same idea. I would probably, again, dismissal tends to carry a little bit of a negative connotation, and we generally just like to use the word disenroll because of not the negative connotation, particularly where it relates to non-conduct by the student, relates to some other factor other than conduct related to the student.
This might be something you get into later, but it deals with employment law too, where you have a contract that's based on the policy manual, and you don't generally follow the policy, or the policy is followed inconsistently, and you set a new policy by disregarding your current policy, be it with the employee, be it with the student, where it's ignored, and that student's doing it, so you kind of point to that policy without being fine.
Yeah. You always have an issue if you've got a policy that you're not following. So then the question becomes one of the inconsistency is always challenged. So we don't minister to students and families based upon policy. We minister based upon people. So there are always exceptions that come up to policy. But if I'm making a lot of exceptions to policy, then I need to change the policy. What I would do, employee handbook as well as student handbook, I would have language that says the school reserves the right to change any policy herein at any time when in the school's sole discretion it determines it to be in the best interest of the school. So you save that discretionary language that's in there. The other thing in terms of an employee handbook, you want language that says this handbook is not a contract for employment, implied or otherwise. However, as a part of the agreement with the school, the handbook is policies, guidelines, procedures. The staff agree to follow the guidelines, policies, and procedures for the school. Yes?
Lay that out there and say,
Yes, you can, and kind of hang on to that because we'll get to that in just a second. Yeah, okay? Okay, so you frequently, and some of the issues that we have involving parents and students is that parents tend to articulate the rights that they think their child has based upon public education, not based upon private Christian school education. One of those areas is my child has his constitutional rights, and one of those is due process. Let me tell you that there are no due process rights for a student enrolled in a Christian school. Those rights are substantive as well as procedural. So, for example, in public education, to expel a student more than 10 days, they've got to go through a hearing. There's a right to have counsel present. There's all of these other rights that attach. A right to notice, a right for that notice to be reasonable, a right to have an impartial hearing officer. All those things are due process rights that do not apply to a Christian school. The reason for that is a private Christian school is not a governmental entity. Constitutional rights apply to a governmental entity or an actor on behalf of the government. In this case, with a private Christian school, faith-based program, there are no constitutional rights, so there are no due process rights. Parent comes in and says, my child has their constitutional rights. Response to that is, Ms. Jones, I understand you feel that way. No, there are no constitutional rights that are there. The only, that I'm aware of, the only constitutional right that may attach is in the situation of, in California, there's a constitutional right to privacy. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Okay, search and seizure. I want to find out whether or not a student has something in their locker or in their backpack. I think that they've got drugs. I think they've got something else in there. There is no Fourth Amendment constitutional right against search and seizure in a Christian school. There is a right to privacy. How do I deal with that right to privacy that's there at common law? I give notice to the student. Where would I give notice to the student in terms of explaining the rights? Go back to the handbook. And in that handbook, I would say, ABC school reserves the right to search lockers at any time, or the contents of lockers, when, in the school's opinion, or there's a reasonable basis to believe that the student has illegal substances, has something in there that violates the school rules, etc. So if I give notice to that, then I have the right to conduct the search. What if I think they've got something that's on their person? I would never conduct a pat-down search. And then you face other issues. I would ask them to empty their pockets. I'd ask them to empty their book bag or their purses. I would have that as a part of my policy. If they refuse to empty their pockets, then my policy is I call mom and dad. Mom and dad come down to the school, and mom and dad have the student empty their pocket. What if they don't want to do that? What if they don't want to come? What if the student doesn't want to empty their pockets? Mom and dad say, no, we're not going to do that. Then my response is, as a part of my policy, is bye-bye. You're out of here. Here's what you agreed to. If we got a reasonable basis to believe that the student has illegal substances on their person, and they're unwilling to do that, then, sorry, we're disenrolling the student because of that. Okay, so search and seizure, how do I deal with it? Not a constitutional right, unless you're in California. And there, you have to have a reasonable basis, more of a constitutional right to privacy there. Okay, what about a drug policy? I think the student is actually on drugs. You can have a drug policy. Again, it needs to be as a part of the handbook. Parents agree to that. You can even have drug testing. Now, U.S. Supreme Court has said that you can even do random drug testing of students who are in extracurricular activities in public school. I don't suggest random drug testing in a Christian school, but if you've got a basis to believe that a student is on drugs, as a part of the policy, you can have drug testing performed to determine whether or not that student is. You need to be sure that you're protecting the privacy of the student. It does not go out. Usually you can get the test results done in a day or two and get those results back and make a determination from there. You can have a student who in the past you've had questions about, there have been issues there, maybe even had drug testing in the past. The student is expelled for a period of time. Parents want him back. The condition of coming back into the school, again, as a part of the contract, you can say, got to agree to drug testing on a random basis, and the school decides that. So, constitutionally, there are no rights. I'm going to establish what the relationship is in terms of my handbook, etc. My child has their free speech rights. No, they don't. There are no constitutional rights that are there. We had a school, this happened to be in California, a large school, that called us and said, we're getting ready to start a student newspaper where the students serve as editors and everything. We know what's going to happen. We know that there's going to be an article or an editorial that's written that we're going to want to censor. Can we do that? Response to them was, absolutely, you can do that. Make sure you spell out what you're going to do. Make sure you spell out in terms of, here's the way we operate. Again, so the students are just apprised and the parents are apprised of that, but there is no constitutional right there. So students cannot say anything that they want to say. You've got a right to censor their speech. Okay, what about discrimination in enrollment, which comes to the question that you had asked, what about religion? Private, faith-based school can discriminate on the basis of religion. That would include whether or not all the parents are believers, one parent is a believer, agreed to the statement of faith. What if the school says, these parents say that they would agree, but it's obvious to us they really don't understand this. Can I discriminate on the basis of religion in that case? Question, answer to that is absolutely. Now, you've got to be consistent and make sure that you're applying your religious criteria in a consistent basis. But you can discriminate on the basis of religion. One of the issues that is starting to become a major issue is what about if Johnny's mom or dad, two mommies, two daddies, how do we deal with that situation? You would go back to what is my religious belief, what do I believe about that, how can two walk together unless they be agreed. As a Christian school, we believe that we are partnering with our parents. If what we believe is so much in antithesis to what is being taught at home, if that is the school's position, then they need to articulate that position in their handbook, articulate why on a biblical basis they believe that, what their philosophy is in terms of cooperating with the home, and the school reserves the right to not admit a student under those circumstances. What if the student engages or their conduct engages in homosexuality, etc.? Can the school disenroll or expel the student for that? Absolutely. Tie it to your conduct. Tie it to your religious basis. And you can discriminate in enrollment or keeping a student in the school on the basis of religion. Just make sure that I'm consistently applying that. Yes. I understand that, but again, our general belief is that if it's important enough, let me back up. If it's not in writing anywhere, I'm not communicating it to the parent. I face that situation and I'm saying, we're not going to enroll you because of this. Parent challenge to that is, if it's not, how important can it be that you're not communicating it? So you run the risk of it being challenged because it's not communicated at all. And the protection that you have is that if it is on a religious criteria basis, then that's fine. I think that you're going to get challenged either way. You're going to get challenged if it's there. You're going to get challenged if it's not there. Chances of having a parent coming in that scenario or setting and ultimately applying to the school is getting higher and higher. The risk is higher and higher. So I think it's probably better. At a minimum, I would have it as a policy that's adopted, the date that's adopted, and the board adopts the policy, and it's there, and you can refer to it. At a maximum, I would probably include some type of language in my handbook. Right. Yeah, I would put it, for example, the philosophy of the school is that we partner with parents. There may be those cases in which what is taught at home and the home environment is contradictory to or an antithesis of what the school believes and what the school would teach. The school reserves the right to not enroll a student or disenroll a student should the circumstances indicate.
Yeah,
Yeah, although I will tell you, a number of states and cities are passing legislation as a part of their public accommodations provisions under state statutes. In those public accommodations provisions, it says you cannot discriminate in providing your programs or services on the basis of, and it's usually disability, gender, sexual orientation, etc. If it's determined that a private Christian school is a place of public accommodation, and the school is refusing to provide services, that is enrollment, on the basis of sexual orientation, then arguably that's a violation. And there usually is, in the state statutes, there's no exemption for religious organizations. So under the federal statute, ADA, there is an exemption. Right now it only extends to disability. But under state statutes, there frequently is not. So then what's the basis upon which I would articulate that I would not enroll a student because of the family's sexual orientation? It would have to be upon a religious basis and a religious criteria. And there's some certain areas that, even when we don't want to list sins, we believe in a traditional family, traditional male-female family. Family is so much in antithesis. How do we relate that? So kind of have to walk a fine line in terms of doing that, but a number of states are passing statutes that deal with sexual orientation. That's a huge issue, and some states have looked at it and said public accommodation is not, for example, a private school. Other states have not defined it at all. The way public accommodation first began to be interpreted was the physical location. In order to gain access to your physical location, had to have a ramp, had to have a handicap door that would open, and those type of things. over a period of time, it's been not only the physical locality, but your actual services that you're providing. So if I say you can't access my services because of sexual orientation, then that's a violation of that public accommodation provision. It's another way to promote the agenda that maybe doesn't make any difference to a restaurant, but makes a huge difference to a private Christian school. So how do I deal with that? It opens up a couple of doors. We'll look at one of those in just a minute, possibly. But generally, scholarships go to the student, and it's not direct aid to the school. It also depends upon what you sign as a part. U.S. Supreme Court has said receiving federal financial aid or assistance, where you apply for it, in essence, is a contract. School or entity, private entity, is agreeing with the government in order to get those funds to do certain things. So it depends on what's in that contract, what you're actually signing, or what's in the statute. Yeah. For example, in the whole next area dealing with disability, can I discriminate in enrollment on the basis of a disability? If the school receives federal financial aid or assistance, you are covered under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which says you cannot discriminate in the provision of your programs and services on the basis of a disability. Section 504 plan is an accommodation plan. It is not an IEP. It simply says, what is the disability of the student, and I have to accommodate the student. The question becomes one, is the school receiving federal financial aid or assistance? If I participate in the federal school lunch program as a part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, I am receiving federal financial aid or assistance. And what I sign, I agree from the Department of Agriculture that I will not violate. I will comply with Section 504 and the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. Private schools that receive federal financial aid or assistance that are not religious organizations are covered under the ADA public accommodations provision. That does not mean that the school with receiving federal aid is covered under IDEA and has to do an IEP. However, you cannot discriminate in enrollment on the basis of a disability. So what is the student's disability? What do I have to accommodate? Under the regulations for the Rehabilitation Act, you can charge an extra fee for that accommodation. It has to be proportionate to that particular student. So, for example, if you happen to have 10 students that need tutoring, and you have to hire a teacher for that, and let's just illustrate it's $20,000 for that tutor. The cost, proportionate cost per student would be $2,000. So I could charge an additional $2,000. What if the parents don't want to pay that $2,000? Then I'm not discriminating on the basis of a disability. The parent is unwilling to pay their proportionate cost, so then it becomes a tuition issue. So at that point in stage, I'm not violating Section 504, or I'm not violating the Rehabilitation Act. Yeah, what you can do is you do not have to significantly alter your program. So if the student cannot function in the program based upon a reasonable accommodation, then you do not have to either keep the student in the school or enroll the student in the school. Student is functioning at a second grade level and should be in fifth grade. you can't alter the fifth grade program to him. You don't have to get an aid specifically as to him. That's not a reasonable accommodation. Okay? So reasonable accommodation tends to be financial or program altering. Now you need to have a statement within your handbook that deals with what we can and cannot do, and it specifically refers to the school will not accept a student where you have to substantially alter the program or you can't provide a reasonable accommodation for the student. Now, that only applies if the school is a recipient of federal financial aid or assistance. Yes? Right. You don't have to worry about that. Right. So lunch money, the lunch program, that's federal financial aid or assistance. The Eisenhower grant for teachers to attend things. Getting certain equipment under some of the titles would qualify for that. However, if it goes to the student, even if the student pays tuition with it, that is not federal financial aid or assistance. If the student qualifies for intervention, special assistance, whatever, under the locality, under IDEA or whatever, that's aid to the student, that's not aid to the school. So has to be direct aid to the school. Okay, what about discrimination on the basis of gender or race? You cannot, under the IRS regulations, discriminate in enrollment on the basis of gender, race, color, national, ethnic origin. Now, you could have a single-sex school as a private school, and that's fine. But you could not say, oh, well, we've got 13 boys in first grade and two girls. We're not going to accept another boy into first grade. That would be gender discrimination. Okay, what about scholarships, offering scholarships? Okay, first of all, if the school does, they've got to be published criteria, and availability. That does not mean that you have to give every parent all the criteria. What it says is, if you're interested in the scholarship or the school has a scholarship program, you can get information regarding the scholarship program and its criteria from whatever. So if you have it in the school office, etc. Okay, it has to be non-discriminatory. Again, go back to, you can discriminate on the basis of religion. So if you offer scholarships to parents that are regularly attending an evangelical church or are supportive of, whatever your religious criteria may be, you can do that. That's fine. That's on the basis of religion. However, you could not discriminate on the basis of race, color, national, ethnic origin, or gender, for that matter. Okay, what about what do we generally do? It should be need-based. A number of schools use outside companies to actually evaluate. I think that's probably better. Keeps you totally out of it. All you do is provide the criteria, and then the outside company does the evaluation.
Did you have a problem with kids with birth discrimination, like you were targeting the minority, the gay boy, the minorities, and then the Caucasians?
Generally not. Okay, generally not. For example, we are committed to diversity. We want to reflect what our community is. We're committed to diversity in our enrollment. However, I would generally also look at a need base as well in terms of that. Okay, what about the rights of a student or the right of a parent to have a safe environment for their children? It is an absolute right. So what do I do in terms of threats of violence? Schools have an obligation to students to provide the safe environment. It's an absolute right. There are several different types of threats. Let's talk first of all, about internal threats. They can be verbal. And by verbal, I do not mean just spoken. That can be written as well. Weapons and intimidation and bullying. okay, what should I do in terms of verbal threats? Two things I have to decide. Number one, is it credible? That does not mean that I believe that the student would do it. It means that I have a reasonable basis to believe that the student is capable of doing it. So a second grader saying, I'm going to build an atomic bomb and blow up the school is not a credible threat. A second grader or a sixth grader saying, I'm going to go home and get my dad's gun, and the dad has guns, that's a credible threat. So I look at whether or not the student is capable of doing that. Secondly, I look at, is it specific? If it is a credible threat of violence, you should suspend the student immediately. There has to be a no-tolerance policy regarding threats. I would have it in the school handbook. I would tell students and parents that if there's a credible threat of violence, the student will be suspended. What if the parents want the student back into the school? Then they have to go to at least a licensed counselor and get a letter from that counselor where the counselor says, in my opinion, this student does not present a credible threat of violence. What if the student makes a specific threat and is credible? Expel the student, report it to the police. You got to tell the individual that the threat is made against. Now, the parent may go to a counselor. Counselor says, I don't believe it's credible, whatever else, but you've done what you need to do. All you need is to keep that student in the school, or let that student back into the school that's made a credible threat of violence against an individual, and they end up carrying out that threat at some point in time in the future, and the school is in huge liability position. So it has to be no tolerance. I'd explain it to students, explain it to parents. We just absolutely, what if they're a good family? Doesn't matter. If it is credible and it is against an individual, expel the student, report it to the police, see what happens as a result of that before I ever consider letting the student back in. Right. Right. Credible threat against an individual, have to tell the individual about it, and I would report it. Now, police may or may not investigate it, but you have done what you need to do. And I would expel the student as a result of that threat. Okay, what about weapons? Absolute no tolerance policy on weapons. The only question here is what you define as a weapon. We had a little first grader in our area that brought one of these fingernail clippers to school that has the file came out, and it's like an inch and a half long or something like that, suspended for 10 days as a result of bringing that to school. I just don't believe that's a weapon for a first grader. But I tell you what, a 4-inch knife certainly is. So at some point in time, you've got to define what is a weapon. If you find it at school, then the question becomes one, is it expulsion or is it suspension for a period of time? I think the younger the student and the circumstances suspension, the older the student and the type of weapon, again, circumstances, a gun, immediate expulsion. Older student, knife, immediate expulsion. Just have to have a no tolerance. Yes?
What if there's something that's dark?
In that case, if it's something that's going to be studied and something that's going to be used, I'd make sure administration understands it. I'd make sure that it is, in fact, I would want it not brought to school and kept with the student. Kept with the teacher. in a secure place until it's actually studied and whatever. I'd probably have the parent bring it and then give it back to the parent and let the parent take it home. Okay, now, what about intimidation and bullying? This has become one of the major factors in terms of threats of violence, and those who carry out threats of violence need to have a policy against intimidation and bullying. Shouldn't happen in Christian schools, but it does frequently. Kids end up intimidating and bullying other students in the school. Have a policy against that. Deal with the student who does it. If a student repeatedly does it, then I would probably expel the student or suspend the student for a period of time. In every single case that I have looked at where a student has carried out a threat of violence at school against other students, guns, etc., intimidation and bullying has been involved. And you've probably seen recently all the stuff that gets posted on YouTube. Seems like, I don't know why, it seems like girls are doing this to girls. End up taking it on their cell phones and taking the video and posting it, whatever. I don't know what in the world's going on. But it is a part of the intimidation and bullying. Those cases, also a threat, I would suspend or expel the student as a result of that. Okay, external threats of violence. That involves usually someone coming into the school in a kidnapping situation, parent kidnapping a child, someone coming in a terrorist situation, those types of things. Need to have a policy in place against external threats of violence. We generally recommend everybody's got to go to the office. Everybody has a badge. If you do not have an identification badge and staff sees you in the office, etc., then, or sees you in the hallway, then can I help you? Can I take you to the office? A number of schools have started to put up video cameras where they can monitor hallways, doorways, and those types of things to make sure someone is not coming in. If someone is a predator on children, where are they going to go? They're going to go where the children are. So how do I take care of providing a safe environment involving threats of violence against students where there are external threats? Try to think through those areas where I can prevent an external threat of violence. Okay, discipline and expulsion. Again, there are no constitutional rights there, but I've got to provide a safe environment for my students and make sure that all discipline is reasonable and an expulsion is not arbitrary or capricious. So there are no constitutional rights, for example, the due process, etc., but I ought to establish appropriate procedures for suspension, expulsion. If you want to provide an appeal right for a parent, I would not use the terminology hearing. I would never use the terminology due process. I would use the terminology a parent has a right to appeal the decision to the board or to discipline committee or to a committee of the board, something like that. Okay, and make sure you follow whatever those procedural rights are. Make sure that they're stated in the handbook, so whatever you want to follow or do or what you do in terms of expulsion and discipline is stated in the handbook. Make sure you have parental support and agreement with the philosophy regarding discipline and expulsion. Okay, what about student records? What about withholding records for non-payment? A number of schools have that as a part of their contract for enrollment. If the school receives federal financial aid or assistance, you have to make the records available for copying and inspection anyway. So if you've got to do that under the federal law, receiving federal financial aid or assistance, even if it's a part of your contract, you're not going to be able to enforce it. So What about if there are state statutes in place that require you to make the records available? There are a number of jurisdictions that do that. I would want to check and make sure that my jurisdiction, state law-wise, doesn't require that. And if I'm going to do it, then it's got to be a part of the enrollment materials, part of the application, student handbook, etc. Okay, we talked about the right to inspect. What about the, what are the actual contents of the records? Usually academic materials, grades, etc., formal tests and test results are a part of the academic record. An individual teacher's observations are not necessarily a part of the student record. Notes that a teacher may make to herself regarding student behavior, etc., are not a part of the academic record. So they do not have to be included. They do not have to be forwarded as a part of the actual student records. Okay? Yes? Academic records, any type of academic record which would include grades, would include testing results, report cards, copies of report cards, those type of things that would be entered on in the permanent record. Does not include an individual teacher's observations or notes for themselves.
Right to inspect is what?
Okay, right to inspect and copy records. Either is if the school receives federal financial aid or assistance, or there is a state statute regarding the record. Okay, what about learning disabilities? Okay, we've already talked about it in terms of public accommodations, etc. The statutory requirements are, again, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. What about contract or brochures? If the school in the contract says, for example, we offer a quality Christian education, the question becomes one of, does the school define what a quality education is? There have been several cases against private schools where parents have said, school, you breached your contract. And in breaching the contract, the school had language that said, we offer a certain type of education. Had a student in the school, was not progressing, was not getting the education that was promised, and as a result, the parents recovered against the school on a contract basis. If I have that kind of language that says quality, etc., and I don't define what quality means, and I accept the student into the school, and that student alleges I am not getting a quality education, then they could bring a cause of action for breach of contract against the school. This particularly falls into the learning disability, ADD, ADHD, dyslexia, other health impairment type of disability or learning disabilities. You can. Yeah, you can hold a student back. I would certainly want to let the parent know during the course of the year that the student is in jeopardy, and here's why. And the parent always has the option of saying, "I'm not going to keep the student in the school under those circumstances." But I would want some type of meeting, some type of information that goes to the parent, and some type of documentation, maybe again a part of the school's administrative file, not necessarily a part of the student record per se, but something where I'm communicating with the parent that the student is in jeopardy. Obviously the grades and the testing would show that there's jeopardy that's there as well.
I
Yeah, I think you can include that as a part of, had they stayed here, the student would have been held back in our school. Okay.
If you say your therapist, we're a school for traditional learners, meaning they're not accommodating that.
You need to define what you mean by traditional learners. And you should have some statement in your handbook or enrollment materials that explains the extent of what you are offering and when you would not offer it. Go back to the idea that you do not have to substantially alter your program, and if you have to provide any accommodation, it only has to be reasonable. Okay, now what about a student's rights in terms of abuse? If a student is abused, has been abused, or there's a reasonable basis to believe that he is abused, you have an absolute obligation to report that to the appropriate authorities. So you must report abuse. That would include any affairs that staff have with students. You wouldn't think that goes on, but I wish I could tell you that we don't get calls on that, and we get a number of calls. Has to be reported. What about even student-on-student abuse? We've even had situations where first grader, kindergartner, second grader, kindergartner in the restroom, abuse occurs. You have to report that. Even if it's only kindergartner and first grader. Then once you report it, you've resolved your obligation legally to report. Now there's an issue in terms of the student themselves. And at that age, generally, that student has learned that behavior from somewhere. They may have been abused themselves. Now you've got the issue of that student, and what do you do keeping that student in the school who has abused another student, even though they're in first grade or second grade? How do you deal with that? Now you're on notice to that student doing that. I'd probably want to have counseling for that student, and again the counselor to come back and tell you that that has been resolved with that student. Okay, sexual harassment. There's the employment setting that's there. There's also from the employer, employee to student setting as well. And you can even have it on student. And this is particularly true, I would say, in upper middle school through high school. Have a policy prohibiting harassment. Reporting, even for students to report perceived harassment. Follow up on it, deal with that. If you do not have a policy, we'll be glad to draft one for you, or we have drafted a policy that's a generic policy that ACSI publishes. You can get that, purchase that from ACSI, even if you're not a member of ACSI. Title IX is if the school receives Title IX funds or education funds, you have to comply with Title IX, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender, and that includes to harassment as well. So upon receipt of federal financial aid or assistance, got to comply with Title IX, which means then you have to have an anti-harassment policy involving students. Whether it's faculty or staff or even volunteers, if they engage in abuse or harassment of students, the school can face liability. Okay, last area is one about negligence. And chances are, as it relates to students, if you're going to face liability on a theory of either statutory contract or negligence, chances are a higher risk in terms of negligence than the other areas. What about volunteers? Negligence theory is that I've breached some duty, supervision, safe environment, etc., to students. Even if it's a volunteer who is acting on behalf of the school, school faces liability for that volunteer's actions. The volunteer could also face liability. I want to make sure that my insurance coverage extends to volunteers. Usually where this arises is if they watch kids at recess, watch kids at lunch, or take kids on field trips, etc., or supervising students on field trips. School can face liability. You can always face liability for your premises. You got to provide a safe environment. That includes the premises as well. Safe doors, safe hallways, safe environment, rugs that are not bunched up, doors that don't close too quickly, parking lot issues with holes in the parking lot, lights that don't come on or don't work, those type of things. I would have my premises checked on a periodic basis to make sure they appear to be reasonably safe. If there's any issue, you've got to make sure that you give a warning. However, a kindergartner is not going to understand the warning. If they're injured on the premises, then you could face liability. Okay, supervision of students. Yesterday we talked a great deal in the one session involving supervision and liability for the classroom teacher. Got to make sure that whatever you do in terms of supervision of students is reasonable. You look at the area where the student is, classroom, transit, etc., and you also look at in terms of what's the age of the student. The younger the student, the more heightened supervision that there has to be. What about waivers of liability? Generally, they are about worth the paper that they're written on. In Virginia, they're absolutely non-enforceable as a violation of public policy. Other states may be enforceable. However, they have got to be very complete, got to be a knowing waiver. Some cases cannot have the waiver apply pre-accident involving a student. I'm not saying don't have waivers. What I'm saying, well, I'm going over here, way over. I was thinking 10 o'clock, but it's not. Let me just close with this. Got to make sure that the waiver is knowing. I'm not saying don't have them. The question is, can you apply them? Are they enforceable? Okay, apologize for going over. I don't know why in my brain I was thinking 10 o'clock. But at any rate, appreciate it. If we can do anything, please feel free to give us a call. Thank you.